Today, we will do the Schrödinger equation. Now, at this point, you might think, what? Schrödinger equation again? I thought we were way beyond that. Didn't we put that onto the trash heap of history? Didn't we go from the Schrödinger equation to the Klein-Gordon equation to make it relativistic, and then upgraded that by second quantization? And now I'm bringing you back to the Schrödinger equation. Well, yes. There is the Schrödinger equation, and then there is the Schrödinger equation. Two different things. There's the Schrödinger equation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. It has no future. It just describes non-relativistic quantum mechanics for one particle, and if you rig it a little bit, also several particles. But then there's also the abstract Schrödinger equation of quantum theory, of any quantum theory, presumably even quantum gravity. There is an abstract Schrödinger equation, which is of the form I h bar dt psi equal h psi, right? That works even in quantum field theory. Remember, we have a Hamiltonian for our Klein-Gordon quantum field theory. So there's going to be a Schrödinger equation like this. And more than that, the ordinary old-fashioned Schrödinger equation had P and Q represented as differentiation and multiplication operators, right? P was represented as minus I h bar d by dx, and x was represented as multiplication with x. Here in quantum field theory, we have phi and pi as a canonically conjugate pair, right? They too can be represented with phi as multiplication and pi as functional differentiation. And more than that, the old-fashioned Schrödinger equation had the operators fixed in time, and it was the states that evolved in time. Again, we will have that feature too if we go to the Schrödinger picture in quantum field theory. So today we'll go to the Schrödinger picture, Schrödinger quantum field theory formulation. This is a little bit of a departure from the usual. I mean, standard quantum field theory, but for the purpose of cosmology, usually one works in the Heisenberg picture. But for completeness and to get a deeper understanding of what's going on, we'll do today also the Schrödinger picture. So let's get back to the slides. Okay, so we go from the Heisenberg to the Schrödinger picture. This will take several steps. And as a consequence, we will find another way for calculating the quantum fluctuations of a quantum field. So remember the picture that we developed over the past few lectures. Consider a lake that's a little bit busy. So there are waves all over the lake. And we can describe the amplitude of the water at every point in space, in time, as phi of x and t. If we want to probe what the amplitude is at a particular point in space, at a particular point in time, then we can throw a piece of cork into the lake, and then its height will, the cork floating in the water, right? Its height will go up and down, and that will give us a measure of the phi of x and t. The picture we had is that the entire lake surface is a bunch of oscillators that are coupled to each other. And this is a way to probe what the field is doing locally. Now, what about a quantum field? A quantum field has now a hat over the amplitude, phi of x and t. And of course, the x could be three dimensions now, or even more. And phi hat is now some sort of abstract amplitude. This is now not going up and down. It's the strength of the field. Like if it's the electric field, it would be the strength of the electric field, or strength of the magnetic field, or the strength of the Klein-Gordon field. So we have phi of x hat and t, and that's not so easy to visualize because it's not number valued, right? It's operator valued, and you can't just plot operators the way you can plot amplitudes. So how would we visualize an operator valued quantum field? And that boils down to the question, how do we measure it? what plays the role of a piece of cork in water in the case of a quantum field? Well, in the quantum field, as we will see later in the course, for now I'm just anticipating it, it will actually come up in lecture 8. For a quantum field, the role of a piece of cork can be played by an atom. You place an atom into a quantum field, and the atom will react. It can be either moved around, let's say by, you know, the electric or magnetic fields, but the atom, if you hold it in place, can also be excited. So by observing how the atom undergoes transitions of its various energy levels, you can gain insight into what the quantum field is doing, whether it's in the vacuum or whether there are waves going through and so on. So we can use atoms to probe a quantum field the same way, pretty much the same way that we can use cork to probe a water field. So we will do the interaction between light and matter, or generally between quantum fields and atoms or individual quantum systems in lecture 8. For now, let's not worry about the exact mechanism by which we measure the amplitude of a quantum field. Let's just assume we have a mechanism. By some mechanism, we can measure what the amplitude is of a quantum field phi hat. Then what? So assume we have some means to measure phi hat of x and t. So we choose a time t, and then we measure the phi hat at every position x. Remember, we have a bunch of oscillators. We have at every point x, we have an oscillator. And the phi hat is its degree of freedom. It is self-adjoint. The phi hat for every x is a self-adjoint operator. Therefore, in principle at least, qualifies as an observable. Can we really measure them all at one? Well, yes, we can. And that's because, well, measurable they are in principle because they are self-adjoint operators, right? The quantum field is self-adjoint operator valued. And secondly, we can measure them all simultaneously as a matter of principle because they are commuting operators. The phi hat of x commutes with the phi hat of x prime at equal time. And so since they're commuting observables, we can measure them simultaneously without any interference. The uncertainty principle is not in the way of doing this. In fact, it turns out that the set of all of the phi hat of x, for all x at a particular point in time, for all x, are not only self-adjoint and commuting, they are also a maximal set of self-adjoint commuting observables. In other words, they are forming a maximal set of commuting observables. The functional analysis of this is really much more subtle than I'm making it out to be, but intuitively and apart from subtleties, mathematical subtleties, of which we are not even sure whether they occur in nature. They occur in math, but our math may be oversimplified. So in principle, we have that the phi hat of x form a maximal set of commuting observables. We can measure them all at once. And then when we do that, so we choose a particular time, and then at that particular time, we measure the phi hat of x everywhere, simultaneously. So we perform an uncountable infinite number of measurements in principle. And then we find for every x an outcome of the measurement of phi hat of x there. At every x, we find an amplitude, f of x. And it's going to be real value because our operators are self-adjoint. Yep?
So what do you mean by a maximum set of
by that, I mean there is no other operator that you could add to the set of phi hat of x, which also commutes with the phi hat of x without being a function of the phi hat of x.
It's like it forms a spanning set.
It's a maximum set of commuting observers, exactly. Just like in ordinary quantum mechanics, if you look at the hydrogen atom, what would be a maximal set of commuting observables there? Well, it could be the Hamiltonian commutes with L squared, angular momentum squared, commutes with L3, commutes with sigma 3, the spin 3, right? And then you have four commuting observables. That's a maximal set. It's not unique. You could use other ones. But this is a maximal set, and that means that the joint eigenbasis of these four operators, the spin operator for the electron, the angular momentum, the three components of the angular momentum, and the energy, form an orthonormal basis. The joint eigenvectors form an orthonormal basis of the entire Hilbert space, which also means that we can write down a wave function of arbitrary states of the hydrogen atom, where the wave function is labeled by those four eigenvalues. Another maximum set of commuting observables for the hydrogen atom would be the three momenta. Or let's just say not the hydrogen atom, just the free particle. Free particle in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So we could use the three momenta and the spin. Or if we neglect the spin of the electron, it would be just the three momenta. The three momentum operators are commuting with another. The three position operators are commuting with another. They form another set. And correspondingly, we get a position representation, we get a momentum representation. By that, I mean a representation of states in terms of position wave functions, or a representation of states in terms of momentum wave functions. All those representations, the position representation, momentum representation, or representation in terms of angular momenta components, all these are in one-to-one correspondence to a choice of a maximal set of commuting observables. And here we have a maximal set of commuting observables in the form of the phi hat of x. So we choose one point in time, t, and then we have these many operators, all self-adjoint, all commuting with each other. And there is no other operator that would commute with all of the phi hat of x without being a function of the phi hat of x. You see, the only other operators that we have available are really the pi, and they don't commute with the phi. On the other hand, we could also choose the pi hat of x. All of them together also form a maximal set of commuting observables. Okay, but we've chosen to use the phi hat of x now at a particular time. We say, okay, the phi hat of x are a maximal set of commuting observables. Let's measure them all at once. And then we find at every x some value of phi hat of x. And let's call that value that we find in the measurement f of x. Of course, it depends on if we do this experiment many times, we don't always get the same outcome, generally. It depends, of course, on in what state the quantum field theory is in, which Hilbert space vector describes the state of the quantum field theory. And on top of that, even if you prepare the quantum field always in the same state, you don't always get the same outcome, right? So let's say we've measured the phi hat of x for all x, and we found the outcome f of x. These are the outcome values, right? For every position, the amplitude that we measured was f of x. Now that is something we can plot, just like the water waves, right? Now it becomes visible. So for example, I did the calculation for the quantum field theoretical vacuum. One moment, please. In the vacuum, then a typical measurement outcome would look like this, where what I plotted here are the level curves of the f of x. Yep?
So is there a reason why we couldn't, say, like at every point have a multidimensional operator that would require more than just a single operator at every point?
Yes, in general, that is the case. Only in the case of a scalar field, like the Clairgeon field, is this one number at every x. But in general, of course, like for electromagnetism, you would expect a vector, right? You would find electric field, momentum field components, and so on. Yes. And then more generally, there will be isospin components and spin components. Yeah.
So really that, like, it's very long. It can be arbitrary.
Yes, it can be. That's right. Okay, so here we are showing just the level curves. For a self-adjoint operator-valued field, it's as easy as this. If, for example, you were looking at the Dirac equation, then it is not self-adjoint operator-valued. And in that case, you would have to form the current. You would have to form the vector, if you're familiar with the Dirac equation, psi bar gamma mu psi. And then that gives you something real. And that's the electric current. And that, in principle, can be visualized in these ways. Anyway, for the Klein-Gordon field, it's quite simple. Self-adjoint operator valued. We measure the phi hat of x at every point, and we get amplitude f of x, which we can then visualize. And for the vacuum state, typically, you get something like this. Of course, every time you do it, you get a different picture, but roughly it will look like this, and it's part of the project for this course to produce pictures like that. I gave you a method in the previous lecture for calculating these things. A simplified method is given on the homepage of our course. And today we will see another way of calculating this, which is using the Schrödinger picture. Okay, so now after we measured the phi hat of x for every x, the state of the system has changed because we've performed the measurement. Now we know what the amplitude is at every point in x because we've just measured it. In other words, the state collapses from whatever the state was before. Now the state is a state that we will call f. It's the state where if you measure phi hat of x, you're sure to find the amplitudes f of x. Okay, it's just like, let's say you have a harmonic oscillator, and it's in its ground state. And now you perform a position measurement, for example. Well, then you know where the object is. And it's no longer in the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. Now it's in a position eigenstate. And so here, similarly, the field might have started in the vacuum state or in whatever other state you want. But after you've performed a phi hat measurement everywhere, the state of the system will collapse into an eigenstate of all of the phi hat operators. Because you measured all of them simultaneously. They commute. You can't do it. And so now you have a joint eigenstate of all of those phi hat operators. Let's call it f. So mathematically, it has the following properties. If you apply the phi hat of x operator onto the state f, then you get the amplitude f acting on that. It's an eigenstate. So the state f is eigenstate to all of the phi x operators. If you pick one of those phi x operators, the eigenvalue that you find is the f of x eigenvalue. I'm just saying that if you measure the amplitude everywhere, then you know it everywhere. And if you were to immediately measure again the amplitude, you would find the same thing again, because the state has now collapsed into that particular state. So the system might have been in the vacuum state before, but after you measured the phi hat of x and you found a picture like this, then if you don't wait for evolution to occur, but instead you immediately measure again, you would get exactly the same picture again with exactly the same curve, right? Because the system has collapsed now into a state which is an eigenstate of the phi hat operators, which means there's no uncertainty in the phi hat values anymore. In principle, here, the functions f that we find, so the actual amplitudes of the field when we measure it, is in principle any, could be any function from R3 into R. It has to be a real valued function over space. And so for any arbitrary function like that, I mean, one can discuss differentiability or square integrability conditions on this, but really, in quantum field theory on Minkowski space, nobody really knows what the proper function space is. Let's just say it's some function space that is very large. We denote, so for arbitrary functions, the state ket f to be the joint eigenstate of all of those phi hat of x operators. Okay, so remember that the way to read this equation is to say, hold x fix. Choose an x. Then this is a particular operator, namely the phi hat operator at the location x. And this becomes a particular eigenvalue, namely the value f of x. And then you find that this is, the f is eigenvector to this particular operator with this particular eigenvalue. And it's true for all x. So you have here infinitely many eigenvalue equations. F is a joint eigenstate to all of those operators phi hat of x at a particular point in time t. And then, just like we discussed previously for the hydrogen atom, because the phi hat of x form a maximal set of commuting observables, the set of all those possible states F, all of them together, form the Hilbert space. They span the Hilbert space of states of the quantum field theory. In principle, they form a complete, even orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. They are orthonormal because if you choose two different Fs, then it means that some eigenvalues don't agree, right? For two different, I mean, if you look at an F and an F tilde, and if they're not the same functions, then it means that the two vectors, the two states, are eigenvectors to different eigenvalues for some operators. They must be orthogonal, therefore. Because for self-adjoint operators, eigenstates of different eigenvalues must be orthogonal. Mm-hmm.
Isn't the eigenstate form a basis, but isn't that because the phis are self-adjoint?
Yes.
Rather than being a complete set?
Well, that they are self-adjoint is necessary, but not sufficient. If you chose just a subset of them, then you could still have that it's not spanning the entire Hilbert space. You need to do it for all of them.
Because they're commuting, if you just take an eigenvector of one of them, it will be an eigenvector for all of them.
Yes, but then you would have a huge degeneracy in there. You see what I mean? If you look at eigenvectors of x1, let's say quantum mechanics, you have three position operators, x1, x2, x3.
Yes.
Then it is true that the eigenbasis of just x1 is spanning the Hilbert space.
Yes.
It is true, but it's a huge degeneracy, because if you only know the x1 eigenvector, then you don't have quantum numbers to resolve the many eigenvectors for one eigenvalue of x1, because the x2 and x3 are undetermined in this case. Right? So in order to have a wave function, in order to have a labeling with respect to eigenvalues, you need to have a maximal set of commuting observables. So to summarize again, it's true that if you have one self-adjoint operator in a Hilbert space, its eigenbasis will span the Hilbert space. That's true. One of them is enough. But in general, you will have large degenerate eigenspaces. For one eigenvalue, you can have infinitely many. You can have infinite dimensional Hilbert space that of eigenstates for this one eigenvalue. And so in order to then also have a canonical basis in that Hilbert space, then you need another observable. And if you use a maximal set of commuting observables, then you drill down in such a way that all degeneracy is removed, and one set of eigenvalues pinpoints exactly one dimension in the Hilbert space. Otherwise, one set of eigenvalues may not pinpoint one dimensional Hilbert space, but just an eigenspace. Yeah, but it's good that you asked. Okay, so what this means is that since the set of all of those field eigenstates, field amplitude eigenstates, spans the Hilbert space, with every function f indicating exactly one dimension in the Hilbert space, we can now use this to expand an arbitrary state of the quantum field theory, let's call it psi, in terms of this basis. So we can write that an arbitrary state of the Hilbert space, of the quantum field theory, that could be the vacuum state, or it could be a state with seven particles of a particular momentum present, or a mix of all sorts of particles going crisscrossing each other. Any such pure state can be expanded in this basis. So formally, we can write that we have a resolution of the identity here in terms of the Fs, and you have to integrate, or path integrate, really, over all Fs in a Hilbert space or in some space of functions. I wrote here L2 of R3, but really the function space is not yet known. what exactly the space of functions f is that can occur in a quantum field theory like that. It very much depends on what Planck scale physics is like, because it very much depends on what the short distance structure can be of those functions. So you path integrate over all functions in that function space, and then you have here the cats and the bras of these corresponding states, and apply that to psi, and that is our psi here, right? It's just an insertion of a resolution of the identity here. The integral over FF is a resolution of the identity in the same way that in first quantization, you can write an arbitrary state of non-relativistic Schrödinger or Heisenberg quantum mechanics. You can write such a state as the integral over, and then you have here the resolution of the identity in terms of position eigenvectors. Apply that to the abstract state psi, and well, you have not really done anything. It's just you wrote the identity acting on psi. But what's important is that this inner product here, the x psi, is what we call the position wave function, psi of x. And we have an interpretation for it. Namely, it is the probability amplitude for finding position x when the system was prepared in the state psi. Now let's move back over there. Same deal here. This is the field wave functional. This is the position wave function. And this is the field wave functional. Functional because the input is a function. So where this, the overlap between psi and such a joint eigenvector gives you the probability amplitude for finding the position x here, this is the probability amplitude for finding the field f, for finding when you measure phi hat of x everywhere, then the outcomes might be f, and this is the probability amplitude for this to happen. Okay, so here, this is the probability amplitude for the outcome of a joint measurement of all the amplitudes to come out to be described by the function f of x being all the various measurement outcomes. All of this, take it with a grain of salt, because I'm not saying you can actually go out there and really measure simultaneously all those amplitudes at all positions at the same time, but something similar to that happened in cosmology. When inflation ended, then there were quantum field fluctuations, and in effect, gravity and freshly produced particles performed a measurement like that. They in effect performed something like a phi hat measurement. It wasn't really phi hat, it was an energetic expression in terms of it, but as a matter of principle, it's close enough. All right, so the wave functional, right? So this is the wave functional the same way that this is a wave function. And just like here, we could have used the position, instead of the position, the resolution of the identity in terms of the position eigenvectors, we could have used the resolution of the identity in terms of the momentum eigenvectors. And what we would have obtained would have been the momentum wave function, the probability amplitude for finding a particular momentum. Here too, we don't necessarily have to choose a resolution of the identity in terms of the eigenstates of the phi operators. We could have chosen the eigenstates of the pi operators. And then that, what we would get here, would be the wave functional that gives us the probability amplitude for finding a pi of x distribution, if we measured the pi of x at every position, given by a function pi of x, if the system was prepared in the state psi. Okay, but we will focus on the case, just like in quantum mechanics, we usually use the position representation. Here we will use the phi representation. Even though phi and pi can be very closely related in quantum field theory too. For example, in electromagnetism, phi is basically the E field and pi basically the B field. Okay, so the wave functional. I think we already discussed these things, but let's just go through this again a little more quickly then. recall from quantum mechanics. Assume that the Ri hat is a set of self-adjoint operators that are commuting with each other, and that is a maximal set. Okay, so let's say that the Ri hat are a maximal set of commuting observables. As we discussed, in quantum mechanics could be the three position operators, the three momentum operators, or it could be the Hamiltonian, if, let's say for the hydrogen atom, it could be the Hamiltonian and the L squared and the L3. But abstractly, let's just say they are some maximal set of commuting self-adjoint operators. Because they're commuting, they have joint eigenvectors. And let's describe them by writing down a ket with an R inside. And the R really stands for a tuple of, or tuple or triple or quadruple of numbers, namely numbers Ri. So we have that the R is a joint eigenvector of all of those operators. The Ri acting on R gives us an eigenvalue Ri acting on R. Just like you would do for the hydrogen atom, where one, the R1 might be the principal quantum number of the hydrogen atom, the n, the R1 might be the L squared eigenvalue, the R3 might be the L3 eigenvalue. Or it could be just the three positions, or it could be the three momenta. Then we define the overlap between the psi, the abstract state that the system is prepared in, and this R joint eigenvector of all those here. And that is a wave function, right? Remember, this is how a wave function is defined. This is psi of R. And in quantum field theory, it will be for wave functional psi of F. So that's the wave function. And let me point out that a wave function can be a discrete thing. If you choose for those three Ri, the three position operators of quantum mechanics, then you get three continuous eigenvalues, the three positions, and therefore the wave function will be psi of x1, x2, x3. It's really a function, psi of the x, and x runs through R3. If, however, you chose for those Ri, for example, the Hamiltonian of the hydrogen atom, and L3 and L squared, then, well, L squared and L3 have discrete eigenvalues, and the Hamiltonian as well. So these Ri run through discrete values, which means here too, the psi of R is now a psi of N, L, and M, the quantum numbers of the hydrogen atom, and they are discrete. Never mind, we still call it a wave function, even though the L, the M, the N are discrete. So wave function is really a general term. And in the quantum field theory case, we may even also call it wave function, even though it's really a wave functional, because then the input is a function, right? Not just three numbers here, but instead a whole function goes into this. Because the wave functional in quantum field theory gives you the probability amplitude for finding an entire function, right? The probability amplitude for, you know, what's the probability that if I measure the phi hat of x everywhere at once, what's the probability that I find a particular function with a peak here and a valley there, right? You plug that function f into the wave functional, you get a probability amplitude out for it. That's why it's called a functional, because you plug in a whole function. All right. So in quantum field theory, then we said that already, the collection of all the phi hat of x is a complete set of commuting observables with joint eigenvectors f, which obey the eigenvalue equation for every x. So f of x can be viewed as a collection of eigenvalues. For every x, you get an eigenvalue. For every x, you get an operator. Then the wave functional. The wave functional described or denoted by this capital psi here. is written in this way, psi of f, and the tradition is to use square brackets here to indicate that psi does not depend on a bunch of numbers. It depends on a function. Okay, so it's a functional. That is the overlap between the state the system is prepared in and the state that describes the field in a particular configuration. I mentioned it already. What is the interpretation of it? Well, it's a probability amplitude that if the system is prepared in arbitrary state psi, then if we measured phi hat of x at all x, what's the probability for finding the amplitudes f of x? That's the probability amplitude, and the actual probability is therefore the modulus squared of the wave function r, where I'm cheating a little bit because it's the probability density, right? Just like in quantum mechanics, if you look at the position wave function, psi of x is not the probability amplitude for finding the particle at x, it's the probability amplitude density for finding the particle at x. You would have to integrate over a little interval in order to actually get a finite probability. And similarly here, you would have to pass integrate over a certain small neighborhood of the set of functions of functions in the neighborhood of f in order to get a finite probability. And also, of course, it needs to be normalized, right? And so the psi would have to be normalized and the f would have to be normalized. These things, highly non-trivial because we do the path integral. But as a matter of principle, this is how you would do it. If you want to actually carry it out, what you have to do is put an infrared cutoff. So you put your system into a large box so that you don't have an uncountable number of degrees of freedom, but a countable number of degrees of freedom. Because instead of Fourier series, you could use, instead of Fourier transform, you could use Fourier series. And then you have just a countable number of Fourier series coefficients. And in order to be really safe, truncate that. That's called an ultraviolet cutoff. So you truncate at the highest momenta, at the highest Fourier coefficients. You just throw them away. And that's an ultraviolet cutoff. So you're assuming that there are no wavelengths shorter than a particular shortest wavelength, which could be outrageously small, so it shouldn't make an experimental difference. And then you have only finite number of Fourier coefficients. It turns out that then all of this becomes well-defined, because instead of functional integration, you just have a bunch of ordinary integrations, still a large number of them, but ordinary. And also the differentiations become ordinary differentiations and so on. So you can make sense of these things in practice by employing infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs.
So if when we want to compute this probability amplitude, you said we would have to integrate over a neighborhood of the function M, which means that we need a measure on this function space.
Yes, and very difficult. It's much better to introduce an infrared and ultraviolet cutoff, because then it's discretized. It's discretized in momentum space, right? And then you can calculate these things directly. You only have to normalize in this case. But it's not probability densities, but really probabilities in this case. Yeah. Then, of course, ultimately, we may want to go back to the idealist case and remove the infrared, remove the ultraviolet cutoff. Now, removal of the infrared cutoff is innocent. We just make the box larger and larger. Why would we want to do it? It doesn't really matter. If we calculate as if the universe was 100 gazillion light years across, makes no difference whether you make it bigger than that. The ultraviolet cutoff is crucial. We don't know how to do it. We would need to know quantum gravity to do that. And we don't, so I think it's quite safe to just take it very high, the ultraviolet cutoff. Assume that there are wavelengths that are very, very small, but not arbitrarily small. And then we are safe too. But to take the limit would be to be able to say what physics does at arbitrarily small wavelengths. But at arbitrarily small wavelengths, eventually fluctuations of gravity kick in. See, the argument is simple. If you look at smaller and smaller structures, If you make delta x smaller and smaller, delta p goes larger and larger. Momentum uncertainties go larger and larger. But by the Einstein equation, momentum, just like energy, is curving space. So if you make the position uncertainty smaller and smaller, the momentum uncertainties grow because of the uncertainty principle, you have larger and larger delta p. But because of the Einstein equation, that induces uncertainty in curvature. Right? So uncertainty in momentum induces uncertainty in curvature. But if you have if you have uncertainty in curvature, you cannot know the distance between two points either. Right? So there's a limit to how small you can make delta x. And the back of the envelope calculation shows it's about 10 to the minus 35 meters, the Planck length. And nobody really knows how to describe what happens then. There are proposals, of course, like string theory, loop quantum gravity, and many others. But this hasn't settled. So for now, I think it's just safe to say no wavelengths below that. And then the quantum field theory becomes well-defined. But we will not bother with the cumbersome infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs in these abstract discussions. Just keep in mind that in order to really make the math well-defined, we would have to impose infrared and ultraviolet cutoffs or somehow guess correctly what quantum gravity is. One of the two. Okay. Okay, so. Right, so we just concluded that in principle, this is the probability for finding the field in a configuration f, described by a function f, if the quantum field was prepared in the state psi. And after that, of course, after we measured it, the system collapses into that state. Now, it's clear that if we have that wave functional, psi of f and t, so if we can really tell at every point in time, if we can tell what the probability amplitude is for finding a particular configuration of the field, then we are done. We know everything about the quantum field. It's just like in ordinary quantum mechanics. If you can calculate psi of x, the Schrödinger wave function psi of x, you're done. From psi of x, you can calculate every expectation value you want. Every probability can be calculated from just knowing the wave function. Similarly, in quantum field theory. If you can calculate the psi hat of f and t, you can calculate every expectation value, every probability that you may want to calculate. So since this is such a central quantity, the question arises, can we calculate that thing directly? Is it the solution to a particular equation? Well, in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we know the position wave function, psi of x, yes, it's the solution to the Schrödinger equation. So instead of bothering with Heisenberg and having the operators evolve in time and do all this cumbersome stuff, no, we can just solve the Schrödinger equation and get to the holy grail, to the wave functional right away. So maybe in quantum field theory too, maybe we don't need to bother with time evolving operators and stuff like that. Maybe you can zoom right directly into some kind of Schrödinger equation whose solution will be this, and then we can calculate everything. Indeed, in principle, we can. So now we're heading towards the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory. It's the evolution equation for the wave functional. This always exists because, as we discussed previously, this equation, you would call the Schrödinger equation, it is true in first quantization and in second quantization. In first quantization, that's just a Schrödinger Hamiltonian, p squared over 2m plus a potential. In quantum field theory, this will be the Hamiltonian that we had in the previous lecture. And then, of course, you know, this is a change of picture. The operators are no longer time evolving. Now the states are time evolving. On top of that, just to make the similarity even closer to the Schrödinger equation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics that Schrödinger first came up with, we will also represent just like Schrödinger represented x, the x operator, as multiplication with x, and the p operator as minus I h bar d by dx. Well, these guys obey commutation relations similar to the x and the p. So we will represent phi as multiplication with the independent variable, which is f, and psi as differentiation with respect to the eigenvalues, right? So it's differentiation with respect to the F, minus I h bar times differentiation with respect to the F. So you see, it doesn't look relativistic, but it is. It's abstract enough. Yeah?
So did you say that we would place, because in the ordinary transitive space, we would have X.
Please speak up a little, because I'm getting noise from the door.
So in the ordinary transitive space, because we have X here, we just replace X by F, because now we have psi of F, and F is the function.
Yes, that's right. Remember that in the ordinary Schrodinger equation, we have X and P, right? Or Q and P. Let's call it Q and P. And here we have the phi and the pi. And just like in the Schrodinger equation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, we have that the Qs and the Ps have labels, Qi and Pi, where, for example, I runs from 1 to 3, the three space dimensions. Here, our variables are phi and pi, and they have a label too. But the label is X. Right? So it's a little different, but abstractly it's the same thing. We just have non-commuting observables labeled by something, namely by the axis. All right, so we're heading towards the quantum field theoretical Schrodinger equation. And here the key thing, the key conceptual leap that you have to make here is that every quantum theory, be it first quantization or second quantization or 28th quantization, if you succeed in doing this, every quantum theory will have a Schrodinger picture where not the operators evolve in time, but the states evolve in time. And then in that picture, this is going to be the evolution of the states. That's just the mass of Hilbert spaces, right? You can throw the time evolution operators onto the operators, or you can have them act on the states. It's just a matter of functional analysis, it's not a matter of physics. So this is always possible. But then the question is, which form does this equation take? What is it concretely for our wave functionals? You see, this is basis independent. This is an abstract state in the Hilbert space. If we then, from the left, sandwich on a basis in ordinary quantum mechanics, we would sandwich on position eigenvectors, for example, to get the position representation. Here, we might sandwich on from the left the phi hat eigenvectors, the f cats, right? So which form does it take? Which form does the abstract Schrodinger equation take when we do it for quantum field theory? Well, here in quantum field theory, if you remember, this was the Hamiltonian. If you use this Hamiltonian together with the canonical commutation relations, then you get the usual equations of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation. This is the correct Hamiltonian. Now we switch to the Schrodinger picture. And you may already notice that there is a little change to the Hamiltonian that we had written down previously. Because now the phi hat of x no longer depend on t. Right? The operator-valued fields. And the operators used to evolve in time. No longer, because now we're in the Schrodinger picture. So that is constant in time, independent of time now. And now we have to find out how the phi hat and the pi hat act on wave functionals. You see, when we write down what would be the analog in non-relativistic Schrodinger quantum mechanics, well, in Schrodinger quantum mechanics, we would have here h hat is equal to p squared over 2m, perhaps plus the potential v of x. And in order to make it concrete, we would say, the p we represent as minus I h bar by the x. And the x in the potential we represent as multiplication with x. And then our Hamiltonian suddenly becomes concrete. Because the P and the X are represented as explicit operators. And why do we succeed with that in Schrodinger ordinary quantum mechanics? Why is it correct to represent the P as minus I H bar by the X and the X as multiplication with X? Well, it's because the X and the Ps are defined through their commutation relations. And the derivatives and the multiplication operators obey those commutation relations. There are different representations too. We could also represent the P as multiplication with P and the X as I H bar D by DP. Right? The momentum space, it's the roles are reversed. It's not unique. But by the Stone-Von-Neumann theorem, it doesn't matter which representation you choose, they're all unitarily equivalent. Anyway, we'll be happy with just finding one representation. So our question then is, this is the abstract Hamiltonian. We want to make it concrete. We want to represent the phi and the pi as explicit operators. And by analogy to Schrödinger's ordinary non-relativistic quantum mechanics, let us try to represent phi as a multiplication operator and pi as a differentiation operator. Because what they have to obey is the right commutation relations and multiplication and differentiation do. So how can we have phi of x and pi of x act on wave functionals in analogy how x and p act on wave functions? Now, a valid representation of the commutation relations of phi and pi is that phi hat acts on a wave functional in analogy to how x acts on a wave function. Phi hat acts on a wave functional by multiplying with the eigenvalues, right? So the x operator acts in non-relativistic quantum mechanics on a wave function psi of x by multiplying with x, x being the eigenvalue of the x hat operator, right? Times the wave function psi of x. So similar to the equation of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, or I shouldn't call it x, I should call it q hat. So in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, q hat acting on psi of q, the position wave function, is equal to q times psi of q, where q is the eigenvalue to q hat, or is a bunch of eigenvalues, it's a set of eigenvalues of q hat. And here similarly, phi hat, the phi hat operators have the f of x as their eigenvalues. So multiplying, acting with the phi hat operators on a wave functional gives us the corresponding eigenvalues in here times the wave functional in close analogy. And similarly here in quantum mechanics, we would have p hat acting on psi of x is equal to minus I h bar d by dx times psi of x. And here we have pi hat acting on the wave functional equal minus I h bar, I'm setting h bar equal to 1, functional derivative d by df of the wave functional psi of f. The functional derivative is the functional derivative that you know from variational calculus. You know, when you calculate the Euler Lagrange equations from the action, you functionally differentiate the action with respect to the degrees of freedom. And that is exactly the same kind of functional derivative. If you choose an infrared cutoff and an ultraviolet cutoff, or even just an infrared cutoff, if you put your system into a box, you then obtain a countable set of degrees of freedom. And then these really become just ordinary derivatives. So what we now can do is this. We have a representation of phi and pi as multiplication and differentiation operators. We should check that f and d by df, or minus id by df, when plugged into this, really give us that. But they do. In the same way that minus I h bar d by dx has the right commutator with x, also f and minus I d by df has the right commutator. You get this. So what we can now do is we can plug these representations, these field eigenstate representations, in analogy to position representations, these field eigenstate representations, we can now plug into our Hamiltonian. So that instead of having an abstract Hamiltonian, we now have a concrete Hamiltonian.
You mentioned the Stone-Von-Neumann theorem before, but this is a different algebra. And how do I know that I have unitary equivalence between? got one representation here, but I can pick another one, and how do I know?
Okay, so Stone von Neumann is true if you even if you have a finite number of them.
Yeah.
So if you put infrared cutoffs and ultraviolet cutoff, then you have a finite number.
Okay.
Otherwise, it's strictly speaking not true.
Yeah.
But then we don't know how really to take the infrared and ultraviolet limits away.
Yeah.
In fact, there can be interesting things happening because of the non-uniqueness. For example, while you remove the infrared cutoff, what can happen is that you get a kind of thermodynamic limit, and you can have that the theory might have two different phases, just like in a phase transition. And that would be a violation of Stone von Neumann that actually has physical significance. But it's beyond what we do now. All right, so remember the abstract, in non-relativistic Schrodinger quantum mechanics, the abstract Hamiltonian was simply Hamiltonian p squared over 2m plus v of x. We made it concrete by representing the p as a derivative operator and the x as a multiplication operator. Now we have this object here, and we want to make that concrete, and we can do it by representing the phi as a multiplication operator on wave functionals and representing the pi as functional differentiation on wave functionals, so that this operator, this abstract operator, becomes a concrete operator on wave functionals, so that this, the Schrödinger equation, which previously acts just on abstract states in the Hilbert space, once we do this replacement, becomes a Schrödinger equation where we have these operators act on concrete wave functionals. Okay, so out of this operator, I mean, what happens if we take this Hamilton operator and we replace the pi occurrences by d by df derivatives, because the pi will be represented as minus I d by df, and the phi will be represented by multiplication with f, and we let then this operator loose on a wave function L. Okay, so what we have is that our Hamiltonian now takes this form. This is the p squared, just represented as acting on our wave functionals as d by df squared. And there used to be phis over here, but the phi are now represented as multiplication with f of x. And now this whole Hamiltonian can act on wave functionals. So, and then I mentioned it already, but in order to make these things more convenient to work with, and also for the project where you are to calculate quantum vacuum fluctuations, and also fluctuations for excited states, and when the universe is expanding, and so on, well, you have the option to use the wave functional method if you want to do that. And in some ways, convenient. It's kind of abstract, I see that, but once you get the hang of it, it's actually quite simple. You can use this method, or you can use the Heisenberg picture, I don't mind. But either way, it's convenient to use an infrared regulator to put the system into a large box, because then if you work in momentum space, you have only a countable number of degrees of freedom. How does that look like here now? Well, if we work in momentum, in a box, so we assume that the system is, did I have anything here? Yeah, so it's convenient to work in with infrared regularization. So we now need to represent our operators phi hat k and pi hat k prime. Okay, because we did two things. We reformulated everything that we did above, where we now look not at the phi hat of x, but at the phi hat of k. We did a Fourier transform. And we assume that the system is in a large box, which means that not all k values occur anymore, because now it's a Fourier series. The k values are now discrete. So now we have, as we discussed in previous lectures, we now have the operators of the theory are the phi hat k and pi hat k prime, and they obey this commutation relation with an h bar, but the h bar is set equal to 1. And the wave functionals, once we work with momentum space, the wave functionals take this form. They are psi, the psi of f tilde of t, where the f tilde is the Fourier series transform of the f of x. Right? If you have a field configuration f of x, you can equally describe it as in terms of its Fourier transform. If you know its Fourier series coefficients, you know the f of x back and forth. So now our aim is to calculate the probability amplitude for finding a particular f tilde, where the f tilde is the set of the Fourier series coefficients. And if we have that, then we know what the probability amplitude for the corresponding f of x is. It's the same thing. And then, as you can verify, we can represent these operators, the phi hat k and the pi hat k, because they are now making up the Hamiltonian of the quantum field theory. We can represent them as concrete operators acting on wave functionals. In this way, that the phi k is again multiplication, but it's multiplication now with the Fourier series coefficients, fk, and the operator pi k is differentiation with respect to the Fourier series coefficients f tilde minus k. And this is now not one of those Kronecker deltas here, which denoted, not Kronecker delta, but the symbol of delta that we used before was the symbol used to indicate functional differentiation, right? This is functional differentiation. But now it's just ordinary differentiation because the k values are discrete. So it's just ordinary partial derivatives. The wave functional, really, you can view as a wave function of countably many variables, namely the Fourier series coefficients, f tilde k. And we're just differentiating with respect to them. See, the k values are three tuples, and they take these values, 2 pi over L, and 1, and 2, and 3, n in the integers. So now we can write down the Schrödinger equation for a system in a box when we work in the Fourier representation where we have those discrete set of momenta. Now the Schrödinger equation of the quantum field theory is this. The time evolution of the wave function L, which gives us the probability amplitude for finding a particular bunch of Fourier series coefficients, and therefore a particular f of x. The time derivative of this is given by 1/2, and this is the pi squared, if you still remember it, right? It's the pi squared now represented as ordinary derivatives, plus k squared over 2m. The derivatives have gone away because we went to the Fourier transform picture. And this is multiplication with the Fourier series coefficients. And here's the wave functional again. Now, this may look like a formidable challenge to solve that problem, that Schrödinger equation here. But it's not so bad, because by going to the momentum representation, we've achieved two crucial things. One was that the k's are discrete. So this is ordinary derivatives instead of functional derivatives. And secondly, because we no longer have a Laplacian here, instead it became a k squared, which is really k1 squared plus k2 squared plus k3 squared. What we have here is this is decoupled again, right? So we have one equation for each one of the, for each triple, k1, k2, k3. So it really decomposes into a bunch of ordinary Schrödinger equations. Well, and we do know how to handle an ordinary Schrödinger equation for the harmonic oscillator. And it turns out that the wave function for the ordinary harmonic oscillator's ground state, for example, is given by this, right? It's just ordinary non-relativistic Schrödinger quantum mechanics. That's the ground state wave function. And similarly now, we can apply that knowledge to the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory for each one of the, for each triple of K1, K2, K3, for each mode, therefore. And then we get the wave function for each component here, and the total wave function is just the product of all those wave functions for the individual modes. And for each mode, we get a wave function like this. The product of them is just e to the power something times e to the power something times e to the power something, which is the same as e to the power of a sum. And that's what it is. The total wave function for finding a particular combination of Fourier series coefficients. So if you want to know what is the probability amplitude for finding a particular bunch of Fourier series coefficients, well, it is given by a normalization constant, which has to be chosen such that all the probabilities add up to 1, e to the power of minus, and then omega k, that's the frequency of the mode oscillator k, times fk, f minus k, minus I omega kt. It's really just the product of what the ground state wave functions are for each one, for each of the individual modes. So I invite you to prove this. Take this thing and plug it in here and check if it's true. Is it really solving that that Schrödinger equation? And if so, you know, what's the energy? And also, you now have the tools, once you've verified that this is really, you know, eigenfunction to, is this really a solution to that Schrödinger equation? Well, this is the solution that we guessed because we know what the solution is for one, for the Schrödinger problem for one harmonic oscillator. And this is just a bunch of harmonic oscillators, right? This is the omega squared. So we guessed that this should be a solution too, and it is indeed. But we know more solutions of harmonic oscillators. We can write down the solutions for not just the ground state of the harmonic oscillator. We can also write down the wave function for the first excited state, for the nth excited state. And so we can also write down solutions now of the functional Schrödinger equation for quantum field theory, where some of the harmonic oscillators may be in their ground state, and therefore they contribute this to that here. And some may be in an excited state, like in the seventh excited state. It will turn out that this means that this harmonic oscillator, if that is in the seventh excited state, if the mode oscillator of a particular k vector is in the seventh excited state, that it will turn out means 7 particles are present which have this momentum. Okay, so now we know how to write down the wave functional for states that let's say the vacuum state, except that one or several of the modes may be excited. So we may have particles with particular momenta present, any number of particles. It depends on how highly you want to excite the harmonic oscillators. And in principle, if you want to describe a wave packet, you now know also how to do that by a linear combination. If you have, let's say, one particle in a wave packet state, then you have to have a linear combination of all the various modes that contributes to that wave packet. But I wouldn't do that to start with. I would just start with the vacuum at the beginning and then write down the corresponding state where all of the harmonic oscillators are in a vacuum. So you sum over all of those k except for one. And for that, you put an extra factor there, which is the probability amplitude distribution for a harmonic oscillator that's not in its ground state, but in its, I don't know, fifth excited state. And then you're describing the wave functional. Then you have the wave functional for a system, a quantum field, which is in a vacuum, except that 5 particles are present that move in a particular direction, described by the k vector. And what you have is now the ability to plot the quantum field. Now you have the opportunity to plot what a typical field configuration looks like if you measure the phi hat of x at all x at once, if the quantum field is prepared, for example, in a state where there are exactly 5 particles propagating in a particular direction, right? Because you know that if there are 5 particles propagating in a particular direction, all the harmonic oscillators are described as being in a ground state, and one of the modes is having the wave function of a harmonic oscillator in its 5th excited state. And then this is the probability amplitude distribution. From that you can get the probability distribution. And then that allows you to draw by computer from that probability distribution. So in other words, you can ask the computer, well, give me Fourier series coefficients. Give me Fourier series coefficients according to the probability distribution described by this wave function now. And then the computer will give you a bunch of Fourier series coefficients and say, well, that's typically what comes out, right? I mean, just draw it from the probability distribution. And then once you have those Fourier series coefficients, Fourier transform them to get the phi of x, right? And then the f of x, really, the f of x. And then that f of x you can plot, for example, with a contour plot. And what you should see is that if you chose the vacuum state exactly this, then if you draw from its probability distribution, just the modulus squared of this, right? If you draw from its probability distribution, you get a picture like the one that I showed you earlier. There it is, right? You should get a picture like this. This is exactly how it was produced. Of course, each time you run your computer, it will give you a different picture. It draws from the same probability distribution, but it will draw different numbers every time, right? So it will produce a picture like this, and you see there's no particular preferred orientation in this. But if you choose a probability, if you choose a state of the quantum field where 5 particles are propagating in a particular direction, then the typical pictures that you will get look like this, except that superimposed will be waves propagating in the direction where there are 5 particles. You won't every time get the same picture, but on average, you know, you see that there are plane waves superimposed on that. And of course, it'll get exciting once we study how the universe's expansion impacts that, how it impacts the quantum fluctuations, how they get ripped apart as the expansion kicks in. I have to go very far down. I think we're almost done. Right. Right, okay, I already said that in words, namely that you can use generic wave functionals, it doesn't have to be the ground state, and then you get various different pictures. The point is that if you choose for a particular mode, let's say that it's in its ground state, that a particular harmonic oscillator is in its ground state, then this will be the probability distribution of the Fourier series coefficient, a Gaussian. If, on the other hand, you choose that the harmonic oscillator is in an excited state, then the probability distribution for the Fourier series coefficient will be more like this, because the excited states of the harmonic oscillator have that kind of shape. And that means that you're much more likely to find larger Fourier series coefficients. You're not guaranteed to find a large Fourier series coefficient, but it's more likely that you find a large Fourier series coefficient. And if you find a large Fourier series coefficient, then that, of course, will show up when you plot the f of x, when you Fourier transform it as a wave superimposed on the quantum fluctuations of the rest. Okay. I have a little bit more on the particle interpretation of quantum field theory there. But I leave it to you to read this at home, because I think we are out of time today. And I will cover this, of course, again in the following lecture. Okay, do you have more questions? I'll switch off the microphone now.